Hey, Feminist Frequency Radio heads. Yesterday was Giving Tuesday, and we kicked off our year-end fundraising campaign. We're planning to make some big moves in 2020 to combat sexism and harassment in the gaming industry, and we need your help to do it. Please go to feministfrequency.com/donate and give today.
Don't you die, you get up now! Life is pain! You just get used to it!
Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love. I'm Anita Sarkeesian, and I'm joined today by two women trained to be assassins by the U.S. government, who then developed amnesia and became small-town school teachers. Carolyn Pettit.
Hello.
And Ebony Adams.
Hey.
Today, we're going to be getting into the mostly forgotten Christmas-adjacent film, The Long Kiss Goodnight. Let's play a short clip.
What if you couldn't remember your real name, your first kiss, or your last goodbye?
Honey, you have an ETA on that carrot?
Stow it.
And then suddenly...
I used to do this! I'm a chef! Yahoo!
Without warning...
Give me something else!
Celery! Italian!
All your memories...
Name's Charlie. I'm coming back.
Came flooding back to you.
Okay. Hello, everyone.
Hey.
Hey.
How's it going?
All right. So, excited to be getting into our holiday episodes.
Yeah. Well, we only have two and neither of you are on the other one, but that's fine. I tried to talk them into doing some like festive programming. And so we started looking up different like, you know, Christmas adjacent options or like holiday season films, and The Long Kiss Goodnight rose to the top. Apparently,
no. Let's be clear. You said I'm gonna be talking on an episode about like Hallmark Christmas movies or something, and I was like, yeah, I'm gonna have to tap out on that one, Chief. So this was an excellent alternative.
I never ever said we should do Hallmark Christmas movies.
Isn't that what's coming up? I mean, I don't want to spoil things, but...
No, okay. We're going to just do what looks to be a bad Christmas movie that's coming up. With very special guests, we're going to do a Bechdel cast Feminist Frequency crossover episode. So definitely stay tuned for that. And by that, I mean, I'm going to be talking with the Bechdel cast on our podcast.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that's coming up. Hi, Carolyn. You haven't said anything yet.
Oh, hi. Yeah, I'm here. I'm ready and eager to talk about The Long Kiss Goodnight.
So eager.
She's
all
too
right.
Busy unpacking the gun that was hidden in her luggage for 8 years. Anyway.
Yeah.
All right. Let's intro the movie and then let's just, yeah, there's a lot. Okay, great. Today, we're going to be talking about the 1996 Shane Black scripted, Rennie Harlan directed action flick, The Long Kiss Goodnight, coming out just 10 months after Cutthroat Island, which also starred Gina Davis and was also directed by her then husband, Rennie Harlan, and which has been dubbed one of the biggest bombs in box office history. The Long Kiss Goodnight stars Davis as Samantha Kane, a mom and schoolteacher who can't remember her past. Samuel L. Jackson plays Mitch Hennessy, a low-rent private eye she's hired to low-rent, quote-unquote. Whew, we'll unpack that. Private eye she's hired to investigate the person she used to be. Long story short, things get wild. It turns out she used to be a government assassin, and the two of them get embroiled in a scheme by government officials to increase their funding by causing a massive domestic terror incident, which they will conveniently blame on the Muslims. The results are a quintessentially 90s action flick, for better or worse, with a fascinating example of a female action hero. Oh boy.
Yeah.
So first off, like, let's just quickly mention Shane Black, the screenwriter of this, has a thing for Christmas. So like, if so many of his movies, Lethal Weapon is an early example of a Shane Black, you know, Christmas movie. But if you just go down through the list, it's a very clear like motif in his films that he writes, that Christmas is just like he cannot stop setting his movies during the Christmas season. So
why not make chaos during the time of year that's supposed to be warm and fuzzy?
Yes.
Well, yeah, that's precisely why, right? Yeah. You will listen, if you haven't seen this film, everything you need to know will be given to you by just going back to the fact that Samuel L. Jackson plays a character named Mitch Hennessy. What? Mm-hmm. Mitch, okay? His name is Mitch Hennessy and he chain smokes Newports. Like, I saw this film when it came out and had conveniently forgotten absolutely everything about it except Samuel L. Jackson and the just killer line. When you make an assumption, you make an ass out of you and umption. So that it like burned itself on my brain. It was all I remembered about this film. And so it was a real, ooh boy, just early Christmas treat getting to rewatch this movie, Anita.
It's probably for the best that you didn't remember anything. And I hope that once we are done recording this, you can go back to only having that one line stuck in your brain.
I don't think that's the case. I tell you what I'm going to remember this time is that Brian Cox, that dude has never been younger than 65.
It's true. Yeah. He still looks like he does on Succession. Like in this film, exactly. He basically looks exactly the same as he does on Succession.
But very similar, right? But also David Morse, that dude has never been under 45. Like these two dudes, I was like, I couldn't believe this film came out in 1996 because they look exactly the same. And yet this movie is so 90s. It is such a quintessentially 90s action flick that afterwards I was like, I need to watch more. Like I need to stay in this milieu and kind of wash the taste of this out of my mouth. Cause man, Renee Harlin tried, and you know I love like, and it just when someone swings for the fences but completely misses the ball. I need to watch like a capable action flick, which this is not.
I mean, I don't know if my problems with this movie are not with its action. Like I think that the action is actually at times pretty entertaining. You know, speaking for myself, my problems with this action film are the other things about it. How incredibly obsessed it is with male genitalia. And
dude, hold on. I need to cut you off. Mm-hmm. How many goddamn shots do we need to see of men putting guns in their like front of their pants over and over, or the shots of like just general front of men's pants, like I wish we counted because it happened so frequently that I was like, we get it, we understand the penis parallel.
But it's also a verbal like motif that runs throughout the entire film. Like there are just constant verbal references to dicks and balls and things, and like there's weird mm-hmm. there's a weird joke where so where Gina Davis and Samuel L. Jackson are in the car, they're getting away from somewhere, and she's like, are you thinking what I'm thinking? And he says, I hope not, because I'm thinking about how much my balls hurt right now. You know, so it's like, I'm just like a relentless fascination with that stuff. And so it's really the gender politics throughout this whole film that I find absolutely fascinating and kind of troubling. The ways in which Gina Davis gets to be an action hero are so kind of defined by, very patriarchal attitudes and ideas, right? It's there's so many references to like how hot she is, and there's a lot going on here. Yeah,
I think the other side of what you're talking about in terms of the obsession with men's genitalia is the utter sexism and objectification
yes.
of Gina Davis in this specifically, and like the way, and of women in general, but specifically of her. And it reminded me so much of the role that female action heroes were, the only role that they were allowed to have during this time, right? That you had to be super hot, and it had to be called out at every moment of every scene constantly in order to be powerful or strong or whatever, what have you, whatever the things are that we attribute to an action hero star, right? There's so much of it in this, and it's exhausting. The
Go ahead.
Well, I was just gonna say, like, the it opens with the very first scene of Gina Davis, Samantha. It's really hard not to see her as Gina Davis the whole time. As Samantha, the housewife, the, you know, the teacher who is riding in a Christmas parade dressed up as like Mrs. Claus, and there's a group of men who are street harassing her and catcalling her. It's the very first scene, and it sets the tone for how frequently that happens throughout the whole film to varying degrees.
Yeah, I mean,
you know what? I would suggest, though, that part of what this film suggests is that Gina Davis is only sexy when she is occupying that kind of like hyper feminine domestic role. That in fact, the film tries to de-sexify her by making her more crude and making her more, in quotation marks, mannish when she starts to assume her previous Charlie Baltimore persona, such that, you know, like her language becomes more coarse. She starts drinking. We see her smoking.
It's a different type of role that women get categorized into, right? It's the like Madonna whore kind of thing, right?
It is, but I think the film suggests that she is much more desirable as the mother and as the school teacher. And you have characters like Mitch, right? Say like, I preferred you when you were a school teacher. But I think the film suggests that she is only who she truly is when she's Samantha Kane. So she is, we first meet her as Samantha Kane, and then she starts to learn that she's Charlie Baltimore. But, you know, as Mitch says to her, like, this had to have been part of the real you. Like, this had to exist as you. And so the film suggests that, like, you can be a badass super spy all you want, but if you are a woman and you lose your memory, you're going to revert back to, like, this hyper feminine, like that's the thing that's going to call to you and make the most sense to you. It is absolutely bonkers.
Well,
absolutely bonkers.
Yeah, I mean, right. I mean, it is a pattern in Hollywood studio films going back, you know, forever, that what women ultimately, of course, in their heart of hearts, want domesticity. They want motherhood. They want, like, you know, the traditional family unit, the traditional heterosexual, you know, life for themselves. And this film is no different. Like, it's very reassuring to the status quo in that way. Ultimately, you know, we get to see this kind of transgression for a little while, but ultimately we kind of know that she's going to, and she brings a little of that back with her, the knife throw at the very end, the wink and the smile, but we know that, oh no, but really who she is this loving mother figure. But I mean, to go back a little bit to what we were saying earlier, I mean, we learned that, you know, her kind of origin story or aspects of her origin story involve sexual assault, right? Like there's a flashback to where a man who was supposed, you know, a criminal who was supposed to just dispose of her, instead like tries to sexually assault her, and she reacts violently and like goes to like take out and winds up taking out one of his eyes. And it's this thing where, like, it's like the film, I get the sense that the film thinks that it's being, like, critical of, you know, of, like, patriarchy or men who would do women wrong, right? But mm-hmm. ultimately, it does that in a way that is very reinforcing of patriarchal norms. It just says that, you know, it doesn't in any way want to challenge, like, gender identities, gender attitudes, things like that. It just wants to say, like, it just wants to kind of impose the you know, a kind of order on patriarchy, you know, one in which, like, okay, men don't, you know, sexually assault the woman, but like that's ultimately, but one, it does that in a way that is ultimately still very kind of reassuring to the status quo. And I think we see that in, like, all the kind of homophobic jokes, mm-hmm. quote unquote jokes that the film works in, you know, Samuel L. Jackson's threatening of anal sex in mm-hmm. prison for like an early character, just things like that, just constantly kind of reinforcing these norms, these very heteronormative attitudes.
And it was so, it was in everything. Like, it was, I felt like every moment of every frame of this film was just dripping in very sort of oppressive status quo. Like, for example, there is a scene, and this is so in passing, but there's a scene where a man in prison, who's the person Carol was just talking about who got his eye gouged out, we don't know this at the time, is watching a TV screen that has a story showing video footage of Samantha in the Santa costume. And the news anchor says Santa got what he really wants.
Yeah, just the complete and total normalization of, like, the, you know, the kind of objectification of women throughout this film.
I think that there's a scene that we can kind of unpack a little bit, because I think it's not complicated, but it is a little bit. So I'm going to play a clip. It's a short clip from the film where Samuel L. Jackson and Gina Davis, whoever their characters' names are in a car.
Mitch and Samantha.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. It's hard not to see them as them.
No, of course.
Yeah.
So they're in a car together going to find out more about Samantha's previous life. And Mitch checks out a female jogger, and he actually, like, almost runs them off the road in the process of, like, of checking out her body. So that is the setup to what you are about to hear.
You seem kind of low rent. No offense.
None taken. Really, I was about to... Hey now! Yeah! Shit.
Are you okay?
Hmm?
Is your neck all right? You don't have any whiplash or anything?
What?
I'm just... Since you almost just ran us off the road, I'm wondering what it is that you take away from an experience like that. Don't get me wrong. I mean, I'm sure that it's very enriching in some way. And I know that she was probably very moved by having some asshole hang out the window and go, woo-hoo!
Hey, I didn't hang out the window and go, woo-woo-woo. I checked out her form, okay? If it's any consolation, you got her beat hands down.
Really?
Yeah. Neck up.
This is exciting. You saw her tits. It's so neat.
Look, it's a guy thing, all right? Hey, now you got a nice body and all, but those, I mean, hey, you can see them coming around the corner. You got time to comb your hair, shit.
All right, so why I wanted to play that clip specifically is because it is the only time in the film where you have Gina Davis attempting to counter some of the sexism that she is seeing, witnessing, participating in. And so she's like, that was weird. Why would you do that? Like, what did you get out of telling this, you know, looking at this woman's body? And he's like, I was just, you know, blah. I wasn't like, you know, I was just checking out her form and, like, you know, her tits were so big. And so then it just, you know, she, like, lightly challenges him and then she moves on. Right. Like,
Yeah. He gets the last word. And my takeaway from that scene was very much the film normalizing the behavior and basically saying, like, women don't understand, like, it's totally natural that men are gonna behave this way. And I think that if a scene like this, like exactly like that, were in a film released today, there would be, like, think pieces and, like, reactions to it and people going, like, oh hell no, like, we need to talk about this. But obviously there wasn't that, those voices weren't heard at the time that this film was released.
And there's also, like, there's so many layers to this one scene too, because you have the only black man in the film, and he's not the only one.
Mitch Hennessy.
Hennessy, who is a ex-corrupt cop who went to jail. Like, it's just so tropey, and it's all of the stereotypes. He's low rent, quote unquote, which is also, like, it's not even a kind way of saying that you're poor and, like, you know, like, a very negative connotation of being cheap, right?
Yeah.
And like a scam artist, right? And ultimately, and the movie sets it up to make you think that, because at the beginning, him and his partner are, like, playing, doing cons, right? And so they're trying to figure out how to get more money out of her and all this. So not only that, but, like, you know, there is this connotation of men of color being more sexually deviant, more sexually aggressive. You know, and I think that this particular scene with him specifically was very intentional in terms of feeding into all of that. You know, like, just like the movie makes a comment about how they're going to blame the Muslims in order to fake this terrorist attack, which I can already see some people would make the argument, like they're commenting on the fact that we associate terrorism with Arabs, which is also not the same as Muslim. But it's just doing it, right? The film is just doing all of these horribly racist, homophobic, sexist things in the process of like giving us very easy to digest, quick tropes that we already understand.
I think what ultimately is this film tries so hard. Again, it is so ambitious. And the reason why it is ultimately sort of dissatisfying for me in the you know, final analysis is that it does get some things right. And it is competent in some ways. You know, it is tonally very uneven and it's not quite sure what it wants to do. But occasionally the writing is very crisp. And I mean, as problematic as Samuel L. Jackson's character is, he carries every scene that he's in. I mean, he's just that good when he's on camera. And he's ultimately playing Samuel L. Jackson. Like, you're not surprised by what you see on screen, but it's always delightful when you get it. But it is so interesting to watch this film in 2019 and to see this relic of 1996 and to wonder what it was like to watch this before 9/11, right? You know, so when this CIA, fake out this conspiracy that turns out to be true, that they're going to, you know, fake this domestic terror incident and blame it on the Muslims. I can't remember what it would have been like to hear that. And like, if it would have seemed completely ridiculous to me at that point, or if I would have been like, yo, yeah, I can totally see it happening.
Well, and it also feeds into all of the conspiracy theories that, like, if you watch it now, I'm like, oh, there's all these conspiracy theories already about these things that they're talking about in this film that exist right now, right? That were all these justifications and explanations for the 9/11 that we now know.
Well, right. And I mean, this is part and parcel of like how we have always sort of understood, like there's always been kind of this undercurrent of suspicion at the same time that we embrace the surveillance state in our media. There's always been this undercurrent of suspicion. So like the things that we also, speaking of this film and Brian Cox never aging, the fact that he literally plays almost this exact same character for Jason Bourne in the Bourne films, I was just like, oh my God, this is amazing.
And also, isn't she just like a precursor to Jason Bourne?
Yeah, I mean, this is nothing new is happening in this film. This is a director and a writer who are very concerned with this particular genre and like, you know, kind of just reaching into the grab bag of the action movie genre. They're not adding anything new to it. They're just massaging it and giving us another version.
There is also, I think, something very kind of fundamentally conservative about the film's premise in the sense that the government operatives that launched this scheme are doing so because they're upset about budget cuts to their agency and how they feel like they have been hamstrung by that. And they feel like if they fake a domestic terror incident and blame it on Muslims, that the funding will flow again. The funding, where has it been diverted to? Apparently to healthcare. Yeah. I mean, like, not to fighter jets, you know, not to, like, invasions of the Middle East. You know, that's not what the film, you know, that's not the government spending the film is concerned with criticizing. No, apparently already in 1996 or whatever, the government was spending too much money on fucking healthcare. You know, give me a break.
And also, it was so great, too. Like that line reading that the actor playing the president does when he says, like, you want to know where your funding is? Healthcare. He says it as if healthcare is like basket weaving or something, right? Like as if healthcare is not a legitimate way for a government to spend money. He says it with such like derision, healthcare,
And so there is that larger implication too that like, oh, if only these agencies, these of intelligence operatives had continued getting the funding they need to just like indiscriminately kill whatever bad actors in other parts of the country or world that needed just like extrajudicious assassination or what have you, you know, we wouldn't be in this situation, right? Like that was the problem was that the government got too kind of liberal or, you know, didn't really put enough muscle behind the intelligence community anymore, which is gross. It's also super weird, real quick, to hear at this point in our history to hear the 1993 World Trade Center bombing specifically
totally.
Mentioned as a major terrorist incident.
Right. So the end scene takes place on the bridge, the border crossing at Niagara Falls between Buffalo and Niagara Falls, Canada. And what I was confused about was, like, I don't know why everyone who was responsible and involved in this fake attack, like, basically the heads of them all died. And so I don't know why the guy is so adamant on making sure it all happens, or who all of these people are that show up at the end to make sure it happens. But as Samantha slash Charlie, whoever she is at the end, Samerly.
Yeah,
what are we going to call her? Charmantha. her kid and Hennessy. They're trying to drive away from a blast across the Canadian border where literally no one is working.
Like, I was wondering,
there's
was
no
like,
bordering.
Where's
there's nothing.
Like, there was literally no one working at that border crossing.
And they're just like, and then the next scene, spoilers, whatever. The next scene, they're just like, he's like, I can't drive anymore. And they're like in the middle of the woods, as if all of Canada is just the fucking woods with no border.
Well,
agents.
That part is accurate.
Oh my God. Ah, man. It's just, I was like, I know this isn't like an important part of the story, but it's such a weird omission.
Well, how about when Charlie slash Sam to Charlie, whatever, is in that that freezer with her daughter, and they've got the frozen man there that they're going to pin this fake terror attack on, and there's absolutely like you can't see their breath. Like, it's so clear that this film is not. There are amateurish mistakes, right? But that I almost found it delightful. But going back to something I was saying earlier, which is that sometimes, occasionally, things happen that work, and it's almost as if, you know, Rennie Harlan, these things happen despite him. And so I'm thinking particularly when there's the Christmas party near the beginning of the film, and Samantha is driving this older gentleman home, and the dude, he's drunk and he's getting kind of handsy and he's being pervy and being a shit. And we would think, given the rest of the film, that she would just kind of roll with those jokes, right? But she kind of calls him on it. But what I found so interesting is that when the deer pops up in the road, she hits the deer, there's this accident, this horrible accident. She's, you know, thrown from the car. And when she comes to, there's this choice she has to make between putting the deer out of its misery or going to save that dude. And she puts the deer out of its misery, and the dude just burns up in the car. And I was like, I kind of love this. I kind of love that the film is like, you know, she had a choice to make. She's not saving that little shit. Ultimately, the promise of that moment is not fulfilled. But then there's another moment like that.
Sorry, I'll let you say your other thing. But the part of that, too, I think, isn't so much being like, well, he groped me and therefore I'm going to let him die. It was like, oh, I murder people now. And I know that I'm like a violent monster and I don't care about children. And, you know, like all of those things. I think it was, I read it more as that, as like she is.
But I don't think we've seen enough of that persona yet to ascribe that motivation. And I don't want to say that the film is actually suggesting that the reason why she doesn't try and, you know, struggle up that hill and pull that dude from this burning car is because she's made a choice. I don't think that's necessarily the case. I'm just saying you could read it that way if you, like me, were so horrified by the fact that she had to listen to this dude, you know, kind of obliquely come on to her and then, you know, trying to feel her up. That I was kind of glad that she didn't bother saving that dude. But then there was another moment like that. So after old One-Eyed Jack comes to try and kill her in her home, and she dispatches him and whatever, and she realizes that she doesn't know where her daughter Caitlin is. She runs outside to find her daughter. She sees Mitch, and he's like, you know, I've got your daughter. The cops pull up and immediately assume he is the bad guy. And I was like, yes, because that is precisely what would happen, you know? And I thought, again, there's the chance for the movie to demonstrate like more kind of awareness that ultimately kind of never came to fruition. But there were just moments where I was like, this movie could be smarter. there's the potential for it to do things. It could be entertaining, but it had neither the cast nor the direction for it, you know? Like Craig Bierko as the bad guy is so ineffectual in this role.
I thought he was very like enjoyably.
I thought he was terrible. I just thought like he's not charming or menacing enough for me on this to buy it. I did not like him.
I thought he did that charming, menacing thing really well, personally. I really enjoyed him.
Yeah, I side a little bit more with Carolyn on this one in that, like, I didn't actually enjoy him, but I felt like I understood that particular type of casting. He's supposed to be, like, the sleazy hot guy or whatever. That's, like,
yeah, sinister. And I didn't buy it. Listeners, write in, cast your votes. Craig Bierko, yay or nay?
Well, I would like to play, just because you brought this up, two very quick clips that I thought were absurd and show the absurdity of the dialogue, and they both include him. So let's do that.
Okay, awesome.
The first one is when Charlie and him, I don't know what his name is in the movie, are fighting on the bridge, and he pulls out a knife.
Oh, honey, only 4 inches?
You'll feel me.
You'll feel me.
So, but that's just another of the many, many examples of the film's obsession with, you know, male with dick jokes and stuff that I was talking about earlier.
And
just
one
relentless.
More. Yeah. So constantly. And her participation in them as well, or that character's participation in them.
Yes. Yes.
Especially when she becomes Charlie, who, you know, is more seductive and is trying to, like, you know, she makes the moves on Mitch Hennessy and, you know, she'll like fuck everyone kind of thing. And, you know, like she got pregnant because she was trying to, you know, work a job kind of thing. Right. So the other one, I just laughed so hard. I have to share it. It's not relevant to anything. The driver of the truck gets Charlie pulls him out of the truck so that she can try to stop the bomb from going off. And then this is an exchange that she has with the driver has with the bad guy.
Sir, she's got the truck. She's headed out of town. I'm hurt real bad. I think I'm dying.
Continue dying. Out.
I'm hurt real bad. Please. I think I'm dying. Continue dying. I died. Oh, my God.
If I would have pulled a clip, the clip I would have pulled probably would have been, there's a moment earlier between the two main characters where Charlie tells Samuel L. Jackson about this thing she read in a novel about, like, as she puts it, like, deflowering virgins, right?
Oh, and
she,
God.
And she talks about, like, biting their ear or something to distract them from the pain. And it's, again, it seems to be just this moment in the film of normalizing the idea that men, you know, like, for her to be this promiscuous seeming, like, woman is a transgression. It is wrong in some way. Like, we want her to go back to being the image of domestic, you know, motherhood and everything that we saw her be earlier, but for men it is normal to engage in things like quote unquote deflowering virgins.
Well, that language is so gross.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. One of the other bits of sexism that felt so overt to me, and like I feel it just feels so dumb to even point it out, but when it's the way that her body is looked at and gawked at and framed. So there's a scene where Charmantha is attached to a, what is the thing? Like
it's like a water wheel, like a water wheel.
She's like, you know, arms and legs tied to a water wheel, and they're basically waterboarding her, but not like they're drowning her. That's a totally different type of torture, but, you know, whatever. So they're moving the wheel down and freezing cold water and bringing her back up and going again and again. So it's very convenient that they chose to undress her before they tied her up, and that she happens to be wearing like a see-through white negligee or slip. And then it happens again in another scene where the freezer scene that Ebony referenced earlier, where she's just wearing a white tank top. So like, and you know, she's cold and wet. And in the other one, she's cold and wet. And like, it's just very obviously like showing off her body and showing her bra and underwear and like really sexualizing her in this very like girls gone wild fucking wet tank top kind of thing.
You know, but see, this is what I'm talking about. Like, it's hard to put myself back into the place of seeing this the way that I would have seen it in 1996. The fact is that were this film being made today, if it were coming out in 2019, first of all, it'd have like Charlize Theron or Scarlett Johansson or whatever, right? Playing the role of Charlie Baltimore. But also, which is not to suggest that they aren't sexualizing her in kind of gross ways in this version, but it would have been even more overt now. We would have seen tons more skin, and I think there would have been more overt instances of her using her body specifically and others' desires for her to attain some sort of violent end. I think we're much more accustomed to seeing that. I was actually surprised, you know, and again, this is the 2019 viewer in me, right? By the way, how much of her we don't see when she's on that water wheel. So she's in her slip.
Wait,
but she
on.
Is covered. Uh-huh.
Well, sorry. I'm confused. So you think it would be worse now?
Yeah, I absolutely do.
I don't agree with that.
I mean, so I have not seen either Atomic Blonde or Lucy.
I have seen Lucy,
I get the feeling that both of them do quite a bit of leveraging, and of the characters themselves leveraging their sexuality.
I think there's a difference between that and this. I mean, like, the character's not leveraging her sexuality here. Like, okay.
Right. But that's what Ebony is saying. Is that the character of Charlie is not doing that.
But we're doing it to her, right? That's the difference.
Right. But what I'm saying is that, you know, one of the things that I was struck by is that what we don't get in this film that I am accustomed to getting in the 2019 version of the kick-ass female, you know? So yes, we absolutely, like, Geena Davis is a beautiful woman. She's a beautiful woman, whether she's got that ridiculous blonde wig on or whether she's got those long blonde locks that made me think, oh man, Villanelle would totally be in love with you. Like, Geena Davis is gorgeous no matter what she's doing. But there's a way in which they try and kind of emphasize the like hardness of it, you know, like she's a very hard kind of sexy as opposed to like purely kind of, I'm not articulating it well, but do you see what I mean? Like there's a way in which they did not lean into like her owning that sexiness and using that sexiness in a way that later movies do.
I will say that so the character of Charlie is that character that you're talking about. We just don't see enough of her doing things, I don't think, to see that she, like, the moments in which she's doing things are basically like trying to save her life as opposed to trying to manipulate people in a scene to get what she needs. But that
right,
character
that's what, but
is the
like,
exact
but there's
same
no
character.
Why don't we see those things? Right? Like, if that is the character who she is, why don't we see those things? What we do see is her, you know, being essentially like a biker chick, right?
I hate that character, just to be clear.
You're kidding. Anita, this is news to me.
I think that I, you know, like, Atomic Blonde and fucking whatever and Lucy and all of those movies, I think that when I think of female action heroes today, I think of the Marvel movies and I think of Star Wars, because those are the biggest female action stars that we have, and they don't do that. Most of them, some of them do, but most of them don't.
Oh, the Marvel movies absolutely do.
Some of them do,
like Black
but not
Widow.
All of them. Yes. But not every, I feel like we're getting more characters who don't. So to me, I'm like, well, cool. No one gives a fuck about Lucy. And like, yeah, those movies are still being made, but they're not like breaking box office numbers by, you know, any stretch of the imagination.
And honestly, I wish we had that kind of information, and I feel like I should
to and, know and like, it's so
which
selective.
Of these kind of like kick-ass hero, female hero action movies, which ones tend to do the best, and like mapping, you know, as best we can, like, you know, by era, which ones seem to do better than others, you know, like what do the current tastes kind of ask for in any given moment in this kind of genre?
Carol, any last words before we wrap
up? Well, speaking of box office performance, this film had I guess you could say lackluster box office performance. And Shane Black, the screenwriter, wondered, this is from the Wikipedia page, so take it with a grain of salt. But Shane Black wondered whether it might have been more successful if it had been about a man. He said, quote, "It might have made more money, they told me. But it had to be a woman. The lead had to be female." So,
wow.
Whatever, you fucking hack. Like this low rent Die Hard ripoff. Kiss our whatever.
Okay, I'm going to play us out into the break with one thing that I have to squeeze in here. So when Samantha starts, she's like slowly getting flashes of who she used to be, and in those moments, like, a very aggressive character comes out. So there is a scene where she's with her kid, and her kid like hurts her wrist and doesn't want to skate anymore and blah blah blah, and so she yells at the kid, life is pain, live with it or whatever.
Okay. Get used to it. Yeah.
Get used to it. That's it. Fast forward to the end of the movie when Charmantha is dying and the kid says this.
So you die, you get up now. Life is pain. You just get used to it.
This kid is acting so hard. So hard. Bless you, child. All right.
Oh, God, that scene was so painful.
So bad. All right, we're going to take a break. Remember, Feminist Frequency is powered by activists and community members like you. If you want to help us keep smashing patriarchy, head on over to feministfrequency.com/donate and give today. What's your favorite? Now it's time to talk about what's been thrilling us, moving us, upsetting us, or infuriating us this past week. Carolyn, what do you got?
My freak out this week is another film that I watched today. probably a somewhat better film, in my opinion. A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. So this is it's the new film starring Tom Hanks as Fred Rogers. Really, the film is about a character played by Matthew Rhys, who I am a big fan of from The Americans. Matthew Rhys plays a writer for Esquire magazine who has a lot of troubles in his own life and who is assigned to do a profile of Fred Rogers and whose life is, of course, changed by coming into contact with Fred Rogers and, you know, Mr. Rogers' outlook, his kindness. And so the film kind of plays in a way as a Mr. Rogers episode for adults. And, you know, it is conventional studio filmmaking. It is not the kind of film that I get, like, really excited about. It is, you know, very kind of mainstream and all of that. But it is really, you know, it is very a very good example of, like, mainstream studio storytelling, in my opinion. I feel like it's interesting that Mr. Rogers is a figure who resonates so much with so many adults right now, that so many of us feel like, even though we're now adults, like there's something in his attitude that we ourselves need or that we respond to or that we lack. I mean, there's a clip from that you've probably all seen in trailers and stuff where the Matthew Rhys character says, like, "You love people like me." And Mr. Rogers says, "What are people like you?" And he says, "Broken people." Right. And I just imagine that a lot of us can relate to that on some level. And I think that's interesting to think about. Like, why is that so many of us feel like we respond so strongly to something in what Mr. Rogers offers? But in any case, You know, it's a good film, great performances. It does a lot of interesting things production-wise to take the style of the Mr. Rogers show and apply it to the story that it tells through the use of like little miniature models of towns and cities and things, which was when I was a kid watching Mr. Rogers, I always loved the use of miniatures and models and thought that was really nice. Marielle Heller, anyway, is the director. She previously directed Can You Ever Forgive Me? And I think she is exactly what this film needs as a director, because the film definitely could have veered off into being way too sentimental, but with her at the helm, she really keeps it grounded. She keeps it feeling real, and that makes the emotions and the sentimentality in it feel more real and authentic as well.
Great.
Awesome.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it.
Yeah, same.
Ebony, what do you got?
I'm freaking out over the film Adam by the director Mariam Touzani. It is the Moroccan submission for the Oscar, the upcoming Oscars. It is just an exquisitely beautiful film. The story essentially is that this young woman, pregnant, is wandering around the streets of the city, trying to find work, is turned away from everyone. She eventually is taken in by this single mother who makes a living for herself and her daughter by baking. and they gradually become closer and just learn more about each other and become part of each other's lives. It is a slow-moving, very graceful, just achingly beautiful film that I was just like blown away by. The director does something very interesting in that she doesn't have a traditional score in the film. And so the smallest sound becomes just very large and resonant in place of like background music. So just like sharp intakes of breath or the you know, someone kneading dough, you know, we hear these things and we just get kind of immersed in the lives of these beautiful women. So yeah, I cannot wait for people to see it. I'm hopeful that, you know, it will come to your town. If it doesn't, I hope you can see it on streaming. But it's Adam by Mariam Touzani. So good.
You had me at slow moving.
Oh my God, it is a very Caro film.
Yeah.
It sounds beautiful.
It is so like, oh God.
My freak out this week is a game. I know it's been a while.
What?
I know.
What?
Apple Arcade, man. I'm so into it. There's so many options of games and they're all in my pocket. What a delight. So I played a game called The Get Out Kids by developers Frosty Pop. And it takes place in the fall of 1984. And it is between two friends, Molly and her friend Salim. And they are like sneaking out of the house and getting into mischief and trouble. And then big things happen. It feels like, so it's set up in this sort of 3D diorama kind of way. So you're sort of moving the screen around a little bit. It's not an overly complex game. It feels very much like a short story, a sort of more visual short story where you're, you know, very light adventure game aspects to it. And I thought it was sweet. You know, it didn't blow my mind, but I thought it was just a charming, sweet game that, you know, really cared about its characters. You know, Salim is Muslim and there's references to his culture and, you know, as a part of character building, which I thought was really a really nice aspect, and different types of relationships and stuff like that. So yeah, it's really sweet. It's very like, you know, kids getting into mischief. There is a little bit of a supernatural element to it, which I think is fun, but I'm not going to spoil anymore. So yeah, I think it's only available on iOS. I'm not 100% sure about that, but please check it out if you are interested in that kind of thing. All right, y'all, you can submit your own freakout at feministfrequency.com/freakout. That's FREQOUT. Thanks so much for listening to Feminist Frequency Radio. Stay tuned for the Freakin' After Party, which is only available to backers of this podcast, which you can be at patreon.com/femfreak. Just go there, sign up for a little something-something every month, and we will give you cool things.
A little something-something.
A little something-something. You can find us everywhere podcasts are found, probably not everywhere, most places though. And if you haven't yet, go to iTunes and subscribe, rate, and review us. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and all the social medias at FemFreak. This show is engineered by Rob Parra. Sarah Norales provides technical support, artwork by Jamie Barron, and our intro music is by Phil Circus. Join us next week for another feminist dive into pop culture. Bye.
Later.
Bye.